the ancestral story for Moab and Ammon. So it is Shabbat, the 30th of January, 2016. We are in Genesis 19 and Isaiah 17, 14 through 18, 7, Judges 19, 16 to 24, and one verse in chapter 20, verse 27. So as we come to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, there are so many questions, but the big question, two big questions, are why is Lot righteous? Is Lot righteous? And why are Sodom and Gomorrah wicked? Right? Those are like the two big issues here. I did a Bible study on this. How many were here 2, possibly 3 years ago? So we've done this together on this exact chapter, and I thought, how ironic, I get another chance. It just happens to fall on me. So,
get it right.
What?
Get it right.
Get it right this time, yes. And so, so there are always more things to comment. But before we get to Genesis 19, I wanted us to look at a verse back that we've already read in Genesis chapter 13, verse 24. And this is, as you remember, when Abraham and Lot needed to part ways. And Abraham said to Lot, you may choose where to go. Okay? And so, who has that verse for us?
I don't think you mean 34. But
Genesis 13.
Yeah.
Verse 24. Did I say 34?
You said 24. It doesn't exist in chapter 13. I think
yeah, you're right.
8 right there. Let's not have quarreling between you and me or between your herders and mine, for we're close relatives.
Yeah, I think it's 11.
Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. Lot looked around and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan towards Zoar, which is where we're getting to in a minute, was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out towards the east. The two men parted company.
Okay. So, that was verse 12-ish. Wait, but that did... Verse 13? What did you have for 13? I just totally didn't hear it.
13 says, now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against Sodom.
Okay, there's our verse.
Oh, I was thinking if it was to do with Zoar, where he ran to.
Zoar is where he ran to, and that's the city right at the bottom of the sea, the Salt Sea. So there is that mention that will be mentioned. And Sodom and Gomorrah as cities. What other cities are in this area? It's like it's a valley in the Dead Sea, and there are four cities we know of that are mentioned in the book of Deuteronomy. What are the other two?
Zoar.
Besides Zoar, there's Sodom, Gomorrah, and there's two more that were overthrown, but we don't get in this story. Adma and Zeboim. Do you remember those?
No.
I think it's in, I didn't actually look it up, but it's in Deuteronomy somewhere where they list the four together.
Adma.
And Zeboim. If you just ran a concordance about Sodom and Gomorrah, it would be in there listed with them. So there were more than just Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed in that area.
But Zoar's not destroyed.
Right. And exactly where they are is also maybe a little confusing. But from this account, Anson Rainey says because Abraham is in Canaan. And remember we talked about, he said, if you go to the right, south, or north, take your pick. And instead, Lot says, I'm just going to go over there. So he's actually putting himself outside of Canaan. And so Anson Rainey says, well, that would mean it must be on the other side. Like if you look at the Dead Sea, it must be on the Jordanian side of the Dead Sea to be outside of Eretz Canaan. But somehow the Kikar, it's in the valley, but maybe more towards... Kedem, towards the east.
Those would be probably also greener because they're getting the rain that hits again, maybe, versus the eastern side is more dry.
Wait, no, they would be in the east.
The west.
Oh, sorry, I'm thinking of
the western side is more dry. Well, either way, when you think about it, it's a great rift valley. It's quite a rift on both edges, but then you have this plain in the middle where the Dead Sea is. And it's hard to imagine this area today being like Gan Eden, you know, like the Garden of Eden. But apparently it was a fertile place you could grow in. And
well, when you think about the I think they call it the forests or the marshes of Jericho. And if you go to a place like Neot Kiddumim, they've developed a whole area, which is the biblical reconstruction of what Jericho was. Well, now, okay, Jericho's not quite here, but it's very, very close.
Yeah, you're right.
So I think at that time, before they'd started
desalinization?
No, I was thinking more of deforestation of the land.
Well, there's also that verse that says before Sodom and Gomorrah, right?
Well, that's what we're reading.
Right, so
Genesis 13:12. But the big point here,
as though Sodom and Gomorrah, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah creates part of the problem.
Right.
The big point here is that Lot went to where it was green and nice, and he put his tents as far as Sodom. And it gives you a note already in Genesis 13:13 that, by the way, the people of Sodom are bad and sinners to the Lord very.
Where'd you get that?
That is verse 13. And I just did a highly literal translation, because I want to talk about what that means. The word ra in Hebrew is very
terrible.
General, right? Ra is bad. It can mean, you know, your soup tastes bad, or it can mean you are evil. You know, so there's this whole range of meaning. Obviously here it means evil.
Resh ein.
Resh ein. Ve'anshei Sodom ra'im ve'hata'im la'adonai me'od. And sinners to God very. So they're very bad and they're sinners. And of course, as good ancient interpreters, we ask ourselves a question, why does it say it twice? Why are they evil and sinners? You know, surely the repetition must mean something. So that immediately sparks our interest, and we go to see what did our ancient translators do with that. We see very good interpretation. When people have to translate the text, you have to understand it. You have to go with one meaning or another. And so we look at the Aramaic translations, which of course were put into writing much later. Maybe they started more around Jesus' time orally. In the Aramaic, this is what we have. I'm reading Onkelos, who became the standard Aramaic translation, but there are several other ones. Ve'anshei Sodom vishin, that's a generic word for ra'im, that's bad. If you've heard in Hebrew, bish mazal, it's bad luck. Bish is your ra equivalent. Bishin bemamonehon. Bemamonhon. Mamon. You heard of mammon? Yeah, we have a word in English from Aramaic too. So they're bad with their wealth, with their mammon. Ve hayavin be. Ve'giv'yat hon, kodam Adonai lahda. Hayavin, hayav, we have in Hebrew, you're in debt, you're owing. We know from the Lord's Prayer, debt is a metaphor for sin. This is your general word for they're sinful. They're sinning with gviyah, you might know from Hebrew. Giv'yat hon are their bodies. They're sinful with their bodies. So, you see what they've done? The ra, the evil part, is they're evil with their wealth. And the sinner part is they're sinning with their bodies. Nice interpretation, right? So you have the double mention of their sinfulness leads to two areas where they are exceedingly sinful.
Do you have any theory why they chose those areas?
I do. And let me just see. Yeah, that Greek is much more generic. They're just evil, poneri, and then they're amartoli. They're evil and sinners before the Lord, but they don't put any extra how they're evil, how they're sinners. Now, just before we go take those two ideas, there are other translations in the Aramaic that are more expansive. They put even more interpretation in there. One is called Neophiti. It's a little bit later. But it says, Ve'ama disdom bishin, the same word for bad, Gvar lehavre, each person to his friend, Ve'hayavin begilui ariyata. If you know, gilui arayot in Hebrew means unlawful sexual relations, often used for incest. Ubeshvichut adme, in the outpouring of blood. Ubepulhana luchaya kodam Adonai lachda. And with foreign worship and spilling of blood. You almost think of Acts 15, the three things you're not supposed to do, right? Unlawful sexual stuff, no foreign idolatry, no blood.
It's very interesting because the shorthand for understanding it is homosexuality. And in fact, what you're saying is there's a whole bunch of other sexual sins, including incest.
Yes, and you can see both traditions in the Bible itself. The Bible already gives you several options for why the people of Sodom were so bad.
Right.
And it's not all one thing, it's multiple things. And then we have another translation, again a very loose translation in Aramaic. Ve'inshin disdom bishin be'mamon hon, the same word for mammon. Den leden, ze leze, like this person to the next. Ve'hayvin begufe hon, and sinners with their body. Begilui ariyata, with this fornication, you could say. Ve'shdiyut adam, there's a little bit of a textual thing there. Upulhan, pulhana, nuchra'a, umardin lishmad Adonai lahda. And here we have the addition. We have essentially the same three I just mentioned from Neophiti, that other translation. But we have the addition of rebellious to the name of the Lord. So they're sinning with their wealth, they're sinning with their bodies, and they specify this fornication, which is any illegal sexual relation, and the way they practice idolatry, and it mentions being rebellious to God. So, very, very interesting to me, because, you know, I like big pictures. They intrigue me. And when I think about, say, what is it about wealth that seems to kind of pull with it all other kinds of evil, including pride, including greed, and including loose sexuality? And you just see it through history, right? We have the fall of Rome, you know, needless to say. And then you look at other superpowers and you think, with complacency seems to come these, or with wealth. And actually we have a lot of ancient interpretation that says the problem with Sodom and Gomorrah was, you know, they lived in luxury. They were in paradise. It was green. Food was abundant. And so they became arrogant. They became, you know, licentious, just fancy word for lustful. They had too much free time and they got into trouble, kind of thing. And there were no limits. It's very fascinating how human nature is just the same everywhere you look. And there's a warning for all of us.
This is a side issue, but he was going north and south. Is that in pretty much desert country?
Well, it's in Eretz Kanaan. It's in...
I know. But
yeah.
The kind of land is very different looking. And then he had plenty of room for his livestock. So he
right.
goes to a place that's populated, so then there could be more conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's bringing all these...
Animals or...
Yeah, all these animals and all this stuff that's going to take up the land.
Potentially. Yeah, you're saying if he was going to more a settled agrarian society from more of a...
It says on the villages, you know, on the towns.
Right.
So...
Yeah.
Strange, not only the north-south thing, but to go into a foreign land, you're a stranger with all your stuff in the middle of already settled people.
Yeah,
You know that doesn't work.
Yeah. So you could see in Lot's choice to go to Sodom is kind of like, I'm looking for more security. I just want to be settled and know what's going to happen.
It seems like it would be less security. I mean, he's got all these people who could be upset or attacking.
Yes, yes, unless you fit in. And we're going to get to that point exactly.
I went to 2 Peter this morning because I was so ignorant. And if he rescued Lot, a righteous man, who
exactly.
was distressed by the depraved conduct of the lawless, for that righteous man living among them day after day was tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw and heard. If this is so, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials, etc.
Right.
Which I had never read before.
Yeah, so we have in our very own Bible one side of the coin, Lot being righteous. And of course, from last week, we know he's righteous because Abram kept bargaining till he got down to 10 people and he figured he was covered because he knew Lot was over there. And if Lot's righteous and some people in his family must be righteous, then God won't destroy them. And we find out that basically only Lot's righteous, so they still won't make the 10-person quota. But from this whole dialogue, we can assume Lot is righteous, right? Lot the righteous. And then we have that interpretation in our New Testament, that he's righteous. But on the other hand, is he righteous? You know, he's not exactly the person you'd tell your kids to follow, right? And so there's this, both internal to the Bible and in Jesus' day, and maybe slightly before and after, a lot of interpretation going around what exactly makes Lot righteous and what makes him unrighteous. Is he really righteous? So I wanted to point out a couple things. First, another thing to note, last week we talked about Abraham being the epitome of generous and how hospitality is such an important character trait because it shows that you are respecting other people's humanity. Regardless of who they are, you want to treat them the best you possibly can. And we talked about Abraham's over-the-top generosity and running and hurrying and putting out like a banquet for many people for just 3.
And this is quite different.
Well, Lot, there's a tradition that Lot learned from Abraham. And so you see here in the beginning of chapter 19, the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting near the city gate. So why is Lot sitting near the city gate? You could say, well, he's just an elder or somehow accepted. He's a foreigner, as we mentioned. But he is there to welcome guests, if you want to see that. When he saw them, he got up and went out to them and bowed down, face down to the ground. Remember, Abraham did that too. But what did Abraham do that Lot didn't do?
Ran.
He ran. That's right. So we have a parallel, and yet Abraham runs to greet them, and Lot just bows down. So he's not quite to Abraham's stature, but he is following Abraham's footsteps. And Lot says, "Sirs, please come to my house and spend the night. There you can wash your feet, and then tomorrow you may continue your journey." And we remember Abraham also washed the feet. The angels answered, "No, we will spend the night in the city's public square." But Lot begged them to come, so they agreed and went to his house. Then Lot prepared a meal for them.
Yeah, this is beautiful.
Okay, in Hebrew, it doesn't say meal. It says mishteh. What is a mishteh?
Feast.
It's a feast. It actually comes from the root to drink. It is a banquet. It's what goes on in Esther. These are lavish meals.
Yeah, but...
And in fact, if there's one thing you can say for sure is there, it is wine. You don't know what kind of food might be there. But they are lavish meals.
Because it is sour.
And he baked bread without yeast, and they ate it.
I think that's really important, because Abraham has these kilos of bread,
uh-huh.
and goodness knows how long it takes to make.
Right.
Here, he's breaking months off unleavened bread.
Yes. So again, there's this parallel, but Abraham ranks up here and Lot's down here.
Yeah.
But I will add that practically, Abraham's visitors came in the heat of the day, so he had some hours to prepare this stuff. Presumably enough time to let bread rise. Lot seeing them in the evening. He wants to put food on the table, right? So he's got to do matzot, unless he already had bread from the morning. So there is a bit of a bit of a practical reason. But I definitely think the storyteller is showing you the parallel, but lots, you know, a chunk underneath. And then we have our verse 4. Before bedtime, both men, both young and old, and from every part of Sodom surrounded Lot's house. They called to Lot, "Where are the two men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so we can have sexual relations with them." And Neda'en, so we can know them. This is the know that Adam did to Eve to produce, who was it, Cain.
So what happened when Lot came to the city? I mean, like, he couldn't figure this out.
Yeah, well, this is back to this, was there tension in his righteous soul the whole time?
Not to mention verse 8, I mean.
Well, exactly, because then he goes out, closing the door behind him. He says, "Know my brothers." So obviously he's a peacemaker. He's calling them brothers.
I think we just have to stop for a second on this word righteous, because righteous doesn't mean he's sinless and perfect. Righteous means he's in some sort of right relationship. We are all righteous, right?
Uh-huh.
We're in some sort of right relationship with God. But nowhere does it say, you know, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves.
Sure, sure.
So here we have even Abraham is a righteous man.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean he doesn't sin. Messes up more than once.
Right. I guess the hard part for us to understand Lot is that he chose to follow Abraham, right? So he followed God's calling out of Babylon. However, he also chose to leave Abraham. And by doing that, he put himself outside the covenant, right? Because right after he moved to Sodom, Abraham gets a confirmation of the covenant.
Right.
And he gets circumcision as a sign of that confirmation. Lot wasn't there for the circumcision. Lot's not circumcised.
Right.
And he has put himself outside of the promise, so to speak. But he's still righteous. So it's this interesting dynamic. And then, look. Okay, do not do this evil thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never known a man. I will give them to you, and you may do anything you want with them. Or it says, do whatever's good in your eyes, right? Do what you want. But please don't do anything to these men. They have come to my house. They have taken refuge under my beam, it says, and I must protect them. So that's one huge hospitable person. Somehow.
So hospitality for him is a higher goodness
than
the apparent protection of his virgin daughters.
Right. So then I was thinking, like, it's clearly more of an evil in his eyes. It's more shameful to gang rape a man than it is to gang rape a woman, basically. There's a level of shame, and that must be the worst.
Am I in the right place?
You are. And this is what I pointed out when we did this 2 years ago. The people in Sodom, it's illogical to say, oh, well, they're all homosexual. A whole town cannot be homosexual. You wouldn't have a town after one generation. It says from the youngest to the oldest, they came out. This is not just their orientation, even though they're in the East. This is an act of trying to shame a visitor with the ultimate shame possible. And if you've read, there's that book, if any of you are literary people, it's something about, is it a red kite? You know the book I'm talking about?
Kite Runner.
Is it Kite Runner? A little boy gets abused.
Yeah, Kite Runner.
Yeah. This goes on today.
Right.
Where boys, men, teenagers are gang raped by other men. Is this a sexual thing? Not really. It's an aggressive putting you, shaming you in a very, very destructive way.
But do you see this as like a custom they had to shame visitors who came, or there's a specific reason for these particular ones?
That it doesn't say. But it seems that in contrast to Abraham's extreme generosity, they are in the habit of abusing foreigners and visitors. And so you could see this as not just, I mean, here we have it in a sexual act, but you could say they probably abused them monetarily, which we've seen in the interpretation in the Aramaic text. So they are taking advantage of the foreigners to the extreme. And Abraham is just treating foreigners like family.
It just reminds me of the story in Judges of the concubine.
Exactly.
And like, how you see the total breakdown of society that they would...
Total breakdown of society.
Hospitable, like, your custom demands that you be and all these things.
Uh-huh. So, contrary to the custom of hospitality that is upheld and venerated, they are the opposite. Society is broken down. Taran's mentioning Judges 19, which is our other text, the concubine in Giv'ah, where you have the Levite hurrying home after he's been in Bethlehem. He's trying to get to Ephraim, and the sun's about to go down. They say, hey, should we turn to the Jebusites? Which, by the way, if you on Emek Ephraim by Gana Pa'amon, there's that gas station. They're probably walking by there when they're like, hey, should we turn, go down and go to Jebusite because we don't have time? And the guy says, no, we can't go to those foreigners. You know, what would they do? They would abuse us, right? We're Israelites. Let's keep pressing on till we can get to Giv'ah, because at least they're Israelites. But then they go to Giv'ah, and what do you know? They're just as bad as the foreigners. They're maybe worse. And they do the same thing. They surround the house. Can we sleep with your visitors? And in that case, they offer a virgin daughter and the concubine. And for some reason, the people accept the concubine, that is. And she ends up dying from her abuse. That is a pretty gruesome picture. And that, and the whole point of that story is the framework. In that time, there was no king in Israel. Total moral breakdown, right? So in some ways, these stories are emblematic, or they show total moral breakdown.
But what about the virgin daughter's offering, the virgin daughter? Is that...
Yiftach's virgin daughter?
No, this is...
Oh. Here in Lot, he offers a two.
Two,
right. It's always two to replace the two others. It's what I would call pretty terrible. And then you could say, well, was that just the custom of hospitality was so great he felt forced to give an alternative, like a stopgap measure, at least, you know, to prevent this evil, I'll do a minor evil or a lesser evil. Or has Lot been influenced by living where he lives in the sexual promiscuity?
And this would be an acceptable alternative.
Well, let's assume in Sodom, people are sleeping around. Everything is possible, right? And so, well, okay. It's not the worst thing in the world. We can work with this kind of thing. I don't know. Because the other thing about Lot, you know what happens afterwards.
Right.
He ends up sleeping
same
with those daughters.
Same daughters.
So we incest, you know, so premarital sex, incest, they're both sexual sins. Has Lot been influenced?
You
comment.
Have to remember also that it was an age of slavery. They still had slavery, and it was pretty much assumed throughout the world where there were slaves that the owner of the slave had the rights to the slave's body.
Sure.
So the idea of giving not your daughter but a slave to a guest for sexual pleasure would not be considered so outrageous.
Yeah,
just
to give a slave to a guest would not be so outrageous.
But
however, Pilegesh is a concubine. She's not called the Amma, you know, so she has a little more status maybe. But we were actually jumping back to Lot and his daughters. His daughters aren't his slaves, but in his worldview, or in their worldview, he is in authority over them. So you could, I don't know, could view some kind of parallel.
I have an interesting...
He's making alliances with those daughters also. I mean, this is like a stupid...
These are still virgin daughters.
There are virgin daughters living in his household. We know later on in the story he has other daughters already married. So he has already made alliances with the people of Sodom. And again, back to who Lot is in his character, here he is, a righteous man, and yet he's given his own family to marry, presumably, with the unrighteous. So there has been a bit of a compromise on some level.
Do you think we should understand that this is an extremely dangerous situation they're in? Like, if he doesn't send someone out that door, they're barging in and they're going to attack everybody?
You could say it is a crisis. There is a mob, and they're pounding down his door. So,
and he is a foreigner. Maybe they've already...
Well, exactly. And that's actually what I was trying to get to, and thanks for getting me there. Because then... The men around the house answered, "Move out of the way." Then they said to each other, "This man Lot came to our city as a stranger, and now he wants to tell us what to do." It says in Hebrew, "Vayishpot shafot." And is he going to be our judge? Like, is he really the judge?
That's an indication of the power in play that Duran just suggested.
Yeah.
That it's a negotiation, not an offer.
It's a negotiation because they say, "Hey, look, you're a ger." What's a ger?
Foreigner.
A foreigner who resides in your land, a foreign resident. That's a ger. Today, a ger is someone who converts to Judaism. That's a different interpretation, a later development. But the original meaning of ger in the Bible is a foreign resident.
Most
of the people in this room. Okay. You don't have the same rights as a citizen. So you are at their mercy. So they're reminding him, "Hey, look, a ger is coming here and you're going to judge us? We're going to do worse to you than to them." Oh, what could be worse? I guess they could kill him, rape him, and then kill him.
Could the lesson be that there's no real way out? I mean, you can't be moral in that city.
Well, yeah.
But like what you said is that... Lot wasn't righteous because he was good. He was righteous because of faith. That's what
okay.
Peter says, right?
Okay.
So you get in some circumstances and there's no way out. If you're offering your daughters, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, right.
There's no good
There's
way.
No way out. You
and
are.
And so God says, get out of there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the bottom line is, if you live around a certain culture, it will eventually influence you, even if you're righteous. Like, it's better not to have chosen to live there.
Yeah.
Right.
There is something redeeming, though, in that verse you just quoted, by Yishpot Shafot.
Uh-huh.
There's something about Lot's life that had been communicating to those people righteousness. They were feeling that somehow the way this foreigner was living among them
was judging them,
was putting them in a bad light.
Right. Yeah,
that they were coming up short of the mark.
Yeah,
and
are you really going to judge us?
That was definite enough and had happened over a long enough period, so that how dare he consider himself better than us?
And that brings one back to shame, doesn't it? Because if shame is the trigger for the enemy, we're going to shame you by doing this and that. Lot's righteousness, however fragile it might be, is stronger, and it's really almost like shaming them and showing up how lousy they are.
Well, I think this is a basic human reaction. When there's somebody who's doing the right thing and you're doing the wrong thing, the person doing the wrong thing often says, you are judging me.
Yeah.
Even if that person hasn't said a word.
That's right.
Just by what they're doing.
Right.
You're self-righteous. You're la la la.
Yeah.
It's like, what have I done?
Yeah. That's right.
You didn't sin with us.
Yeah. Sorry.
So are you suggesting that Lot's a missionary here?
Again, there's two sides of this coin. In some ways, he is a missionary. They are so dark and evil that his little light has been shining in contrast to what they've been doing. And what my dad was pointing out was that the grammatical construction there hints that it's not just in this case, it's been an ongoing thing. Have you been a resident with us and you're always a judger? That's kind of what it's implying. And so so you have this pattern that, Lot's presence there has brought, they have perceived it as judging their own actions. So somehow he is, again, Sadiq Bisdom. He is a righteous man among Sodom. And of course we think about Noah, right? Noah was righteous in his generation. The first thing he does after the flood is get drunk, right? Which also is the first thing Lot does after the destruction. You have many parallels there. They got two daughters.
But Lot was also a blessing to Sodom and Gomorrah because it was because of him that Abraham came and rescued those battles.
Yes, it was because of Lot, Abraham rescued them earlier.
That just happened before that.
That's right.
So they've already forgotten all this.
They've already forgotten all the blessing they got because of Lot's presence. And
or Davka is again that kind of what you're going to be blessing us. You know, it's a humbling thing to receive, right? You know, just kind of irritated.
I guess they're irritated one way or another with his actions that are better than theirs. And he has been able to not tip the boat. We see he's made marriage allegiances with them. He has managed to live with them. We don't have a story that they've abused him like they're wanting to do to these strangers. So even as a stranger, he's been able to make some inroads and have an impact, but clearly not enough for them. They were just so far down the path of darkness that they refused to turn. And okay, let's look at...
If on that line, a bit later, you've got this whole thing about the sons-in-law.
Mm-hmm. Okay, first of all...
So in 14, and I've got a footnote. Are they sons-in-law pledged to marry, or are they actually married? But they're the ones who basically won't move.
Right,
When exactly. The crunch comes.
Well, so that's the thing, because, okay, so then that's the... When the people threaten to break down the door... That's a limit. That's when the angels all of a sudden somehow reach out, grab him, pull him in, and say, okay, we got to get out of here now. Who else do you have in this city? Anybody? Sons, daughters, married, in-laws, and go talk to them now because we're leaving. And so then he says, tell him to leave now because we're about to destroy the city. The Lord has heard all of the evil that is here, so he sent us to destroy it. And the interesting thing, that word evil is actually tsa'aka. It's a shout. It's an outcry. And that struck my ears again, because usually you hear this when there is economic injustice. The plight of the people being oppressed is the cry out. And so God's heard the tsa'aka from those people.
What's this word outcry in Hebrew?
Tsa'aka.
How do you spell it?
Tzadik ayin kuf he.
Maybe that's your hon, you're thinking. Could that be where
the hon, back to this interpretation, what made Sodom evil? Being evil with their money, sinning with their bodies, was that one interpretation we saw in the Aramaic translation. And here we could have a hint of that with choosing the word for tse'aka, this outrage that is a product of oppression. Of course, you could also say it's a product of all kinds of evil. Maybe the other abused foreigners cried out.
Is it the same word in the Exodus story? I've heard the outcry of your people.
Outcry of my people. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, wow.
We know that he had other daughters who were married in the culture.
Exactly, yes.
14 says he spoke to his sons-in-law who were going to marry his daughters, which could be the two.
We don't know if that's interpretation that they were going to. It just says Hatanav, his sons-in-law. So whether they just signed were engaged treaty, or whether they were already married, living with those daughters, we don't know.
But they're still virgins.
No, those are other daughters. I'm talking about, because the angels say, who else do you have here? Do you have any in-laws? Do you have anybody connected to you?
But I'm always wondering, who's crying out to the Lord in Sodom and Gomorrah?
Well, maybe they're just crying out from the oppression. And God sees when they cry out from the oppression.
Because it says here the outcry to the Lord, so that's not a good translation.
We just have to read Isaiah 5 a second. Let me.
Or it could Levitt's crown, like in Anna's school.
Yeah, like that kind of blood crying up.
Where is he having his other daughters who are here and living?
Sorry, what?
Where does he have other daughters? Where is it?
Well, it doesn't, it's just implied, because the foreigners, sorry, the angels say, do you have any sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or any other relatives? If you do, tell them to leave now because we are about to destroy the city. And then the next verse, so Lot went out and said, it says to future son-in-laws, it just says he went out and said to his son-in-laws, hurry and leave the city.
They didn't get it.
And they thought he was joking.
Maybe,
maybe not. Maybe, we don't know how many daughters Lot has.
So
maybe there were other daughters.
Well, then there could also be other sons.
There could have been other sons. All we know is when he left, he only had the two daughters with him that were literally in his household.
His angels only had four.
Yeah. Okay, listen to Isaiah, because he's one of the greatest poets ever. In chapter 5, when he does his song of the vineyard, and the vineyard is comparison to Israel. Chapter 5, verse 7. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are the planting of his delight. And he had hoped for mishpat. Vehine mishpach. Do you hear it? He'd hoped for justice, and here slaughter, or I don't know.
I've got sore bloodshed.
Yeah.
For righteousness, but heard cries of distress.
But notice the words he chose for these things. They sound similar. So because they sound similar, you're aware of the deep difference, the opposites. Mishpat, mispach.
Oh, mispach is bloodshed.
Yeah. It's one word. It's kind of a rare word. Okay, Isaiah's a poet, right? He's writing poetry. We expected mishpat, but instead of mishpat, we got mispach, bloodshed.
Right.
Instead of righteousness, bloodshed. And then the next contrast he holds up, we expected tzedakah, right, this righteousness.
Oh, we got tzedakah.
And instead we got tze'aka.
Oh, that's amazing.
Which is an outcry. And so this is the same thing going on in our text. When it talks about this outcry, the outcry is a result of an unjust society. And you could view it on many levels, but it's often in the context of economic oppression.
You said you're talking about how wealth can lead to so many sins earlier.
Yeah.
It's not like economic oppression can also lead to many oppressions. You know, if you have to become a sexual slave, or you have
right.
to, you know, live on the streets, or all these kinds of things.
Exactly. Economic oppression can lead to many other oppressions. And in most cases, if you want to look at wealth, it's often built on economic oppression. You know? It's very rare to find just true win-win economics. So then in chapter 5, he also, in Isaiah, no, it's chapter 1, right?
Yeah.
If it hadn't been for God's great mercy, we would have been Sodom. We would have been Gomorrah. So Isaiah is comparing his fellow countrymen. Like, you know, you think you're good? You think you're chosen? Well, you're almost just like Sodom. Your oppression and your wickedness is what they were doing. And if it weren't for God's mercy, we'd be overthrown just like them. Those are very, very powerful words.
If you look at Isaiah 1:17, it goes into what they were doing.
Okay, Isaiah 1:17.
Huh.
Well, that's...
The comparison why they're like Sodom. Isaiah 1:17.
Learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed, take up the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow.
Yeah. So the righteous help the people that are the underdogs. The wicked take advantage of them. And you could see this on many levels. And so back to Sodom, what made it so wicked Well, not only do they not help the underdogs, and if you're a foreigner, you're definitely an underdog. You don't have the standing as a citizen. They don't just not help them. They actively go out to hurt them. That's even like worse. That is the peak of wickedness. And in this example, it's a sexual assault as well. It's a shameful sexual act. I wanted to also pull...
And also you've got the same contrast between hospitality on the one hand, which is Abraham, and now we have Lot to maybe a lesser extent, but nevertheless, it's the complete contrast, which is shaming the foreigner, because after all, rather than being hospitable to Lot and being the same, equally hospitable, they're doing the exact opposite.
Exactly. So, another text to remind ourselves of in this whole question of the people of Sodom. I'll just read to you for lack of time. Ezekiel 16:49-50. Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, surfeit of food, extra food, and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and needy. They were haughty and did abominable things before me. Therefore, I removed them when I saw it. That is Ezekiel chapter 16:49-50. So the sins of Sodom that Ezekiel's emphasizing are pride, and basically, you have extra wealth and you're not doing the right thing with it. Now, if that doesn't pack a punch, I don't know what does.
That will lead directly to that kind of sin, will lead directly down the road to Sodom.
Yeah.
It
leads to all the other sins. And it's interesting because I know this story gets a lot of focus in the church these days, especially in America and Western churches, because there are so many asking questions about homosexuality. And I would say take a step back. I think it's clear, as I've reevaluated all the things in the Bible, that homosexuality is wrong. However, it's also very clear that pride is wrong. And it's also very clear that incest is wrong. And adultery. And pornography. And not helping the poor and needy. And if you're going to point your finger in one area, you better equally point it in the other. And if you think homosexuality is ruining America, well, so is pornography. So is cheating on people. And so is oppressing the poor.
Right.
And you have to be equally disgusted in your heart with those things than with the other. And
that's very powerful.
And equally checking your own heart. You know, you think, well, you know, you look at one sin, you think, how could you live with yourself doing that? Well, how can you live with yourself doing this, you know? So it's very challenging to us all. Because as I mentioned in previous Bible studies, I'm very convicted, because if you look at the world, I am wealthy.
Yeah.
Even though I feel like I'm barely making it. But on a world perspective, I'm wealthy. I live in a house. You know, I have clean water. I can brush my teeth in the morning.
You got food most days.
And what am I doing with it?
You're not oppressing the poor with it. You're living. You're taking care of your family.
I'm living, taking care of my family. But I also have to constantly reevaluate the products I buy. Are they oppressing the poor? What kind of child slavery is going on to give me that product?
You know, there's a story like this in the future as well, where a prophet will come, and it says, and it's also destruction. It says this land will be completely destroyed if the prophet Elijah doesn't come and restore the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children of the fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is epidemic today.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's a word to all of us to be more like Abraham. And had Lot stayed with Abraham, maybe he would learn his generosity to the full. And the heart of generosity is seeing that other people are first and foremost people. just like you. And you should treat them the way you wish people would treat you. And so to see humanity first, before all the other labels of, oh, well, you're this people group and not my people group, or whatever other labels we have that we put on people. And so I see that we're out of time, and I also see we didn't get to Isaiah 17. We did get to Isaiah, just not the the section for today.
That was great, thank you.
What can you do? So, with that, keep reading through it. And I don't know, if you have awesome connections from chapter 17 of Isaiah that you really didn't get to say, write them up and we'll say them next week before we continue on with the study. And the worship service is starting downstairs, so make your way. And Shabbat Shalom.
I have to go. So I'm not staying for more than 5 minutes of worship.